and went straight into a ritual and legalism and rules of its own. The average Christian today, you say, what's Christian? They say, do this, do that, don't do that, don't do this other. That isn't what makes a Christian. Paradoxically, God offers the gift of His Spirit to those that are living by faith. And in a sense, Christianity is harder when you understand it, because the tension's always there. You must always be living by faith and reaching out in ever-increasing faith every day. But it's easier because it can be done. And the Spirit comes in you. I don't want to just create fear. Every single one of these occasions has common denominators. You don't have to agree with everything the Catholic exorcist does. I will take you into Unger's study of demonology, graduate of Dallas Theological Seminary, probably the evangelical Bible on the subject. He has a long section on the exorcisms that were going on among the Jews in Jesus' day. Their formula got results. God has responded to exorcism and helped with His power to overpower the demon in more than one manner. I'm not a Catholic, but I admire these Catholic demonologists for knowing who the enemy is. Now it's too hot again. Find something in the middle. I'd like to do just a little bit of solid basic teaching in the middle of the storytelling to help you find the common denominators. Boy, that came on like a hurricane. Every one of these people, you can find if you probe not only the absence of faith as we teach it, but something that brought on the initial action. Having interviewed the Glatzels, this is Devlin, Connecticut, and later having witnessed David Glatzel under attack, the Warrens had little doubt that what was happening in Brookfield conformed to the known stages of preternatural manifestation. Demonology is a category of theology, and as an academic discipline, has its own literature and history of cases that have been studied extensively over years. And I can tell you, I can fill a whole wall with a library on demonology in the Christian stream. The subject is taught only in seminaries and the pontifical universities in Rome, as a Catholic speaking. In January 1975, however, a closed-door, invitation-only conference was held in the United States at the University of Notre Dame. The conference, quote, a theological, psychological, medical symposium on the phenomenon labeled as demonic, end quote, resulted in the presentation of some 24 scholarly papers. Now, these papers resulted in a book. Write it down. You may want to look for it. We'll get it in our bookstore. Demon Possession, John Warwick Montgomery, the editor, Minneapolis, put out by the Bethany Fellowship, 1976. 24 scholarly papers at this symposium, which confirmed the austere reality of diabolical oppression and possession. Now we're moving into some scholarly areas. And when I started on this subject, I wondered if you'd think I was nuts. But I think you're beginning to find out it's a serious subject. Preternatural manifestation occur in a five-step progression: encroachment, infestation, oppression, possession, death. First occurs the encroachment or permission stage, where a negative spirit is given access to a human being through either voluntary means, satanic rituals, or involuntary means, curses. The essential point to remember is that doors have to be opened for the phenomena to occur. Leave the occult alone, your chances of having spirit problems is almost nil. Not quite, but a better way to say it is, that's one area you open yourself up. Leaving it alone does not guarantee that spirit problems are nil. Next comes the infestation stage, where the negative spirits or spirit physically enters the home or lives of human beings and causes fearful phenomena. For some strange reason, The infesting entity presents itself usually after making an obvious, comprehensible warning of its arrival, such as three audible knocks at the door. They say only does it. I don't agree with that. But usually there is some kind of warning. In this case, the Spirit said, beware, in the first manifestation in the water bedroom at the rented house. And the family had backed off instantly and left the thing alone, or got the place exercised and bound. Wouldn't have gone any further. They didn't. They fought over it. One of the mistakes that people make is they question the truth and the story. You know, it's like the current problems with child molestation. People are finally starting to take the stories that kids tell as true. Now, obviously, hysteria can make it get out of hand. But don't rule out something your kids tell you out of hand. If you read this book, and I will be giving it away without going through all the phases, one of the things that leaps out at you at the second interview with the Glatzels on the afternoon of July 14th, it was disproved that the initial encroachment or permission for the Spirit's entry into the lives of this family had occurred on July 2nd at the rental house, even though a warning came then. Instead, the Warrens, on probing and interviews, learned that the Glatzels, like a great many other Americans, had dabbled in the occult. In the early 1970s, a course on witchcraft and the occult was offered at Brookfield High School. At that time, there was enormous interest in astrology and the supernatural. Debbie Glatzel took the course as an elective and wrote a short paper on witchcraft. This heightened her interest in the occult, and when she graduated, she went a step further and bought a Ouija board. We're back to the Donovan's house again. Like most people who've never played with the board, she considered it a toy. She didn't know the Ouija board could be, as the Warrens put it, a telegraph set to the beyond. Unfortunately, she was one of the few people who got the board to really work. Most people don't. It was talkative, Debbie told Ed and Lorraine Warren. When I used it with someone, usually my mother, Alan, or a girlfriend, it gave true answers. The thing was really prissy, though. It said it wouldn't talk to me unless I kept it spotlessly dusted and stored in a pillowcase under my bed. It said it liked the dark. One time it even said it wanted to make love to me, however they were supposed to do that. That would have been an incubus entity, Lorraine replied, a spirit well known in the history of demon hierarchy. Did it give a name? Yes, it gave me a weird name, full of Z's and K's, but I couldn't pronounce it, Debbie answered. The thing said it had died in a dungeon for something it didn't do. Did it tell you anything of substance, or it was just a lot of nonsense, Ed said. There was no nonsense about it, she said. One night, when I was pregnant, I asked if I'd have a boy or a girl. It said a boy. I kept asking questions, and it told me the month, day, and minute of the child's birth, and its exact weight to the ounce. Every prediction it had given me proved to be absolutely true. What became of the boy, Lorraine asked. It became surreal, it scared me, and I threw it out. I just knew there was something wrong about it. The thing seemed to have a mind of its own. Now, let me pick up another. I could go further than that. That's one dabbling. Further interrogation by Father D. Giovanni. When they came for the first exorcism, the young priest began by asking about the family's medical and psychological background. While Father D. Giovanni found nothing noteworthy about the family's psychological history, it was apparent that they had experienced a variety of severe physical injuries. A year and a half earlier, in spring 1979, following a trip to upstate New York, Judy collapsed in the doorway of the kitchen and was bedridden for a month with sciatic nerve trouble. Strangely, the first day she was back on her feet and able to walk. Most of you know the pain of a sciatic nerve attack. It can be normal, I guess. But in this case, they're abnormal circumstances. Carl Glatzel collapsed in the very same spot. Suddenly, he couldn't walk. He, too, was crippled with the sciatica. Judy noted also that various members of the family had felt a cold spot in that very place in the kitchen ever since the troubles began on July 2nd. In 1977, David, later to be the target, had been sledding and came into the house with a foot-long stake embedded in his stomach, an injury so severe that his spleen had to be removed. 4 years earlier, young Carl had fallen off his bike. When Carl Sr. walked into the hospital emergency room and saw his son's mangled face and broken jaw, he fainted. Then Judy made a curious aside while she was telling these stories as though they had a curse on them. David's injury in 77 and her and Carl's sciatic nerve trouble in 79 happened immediately upon returning from their annual snowmobile trip to Old Forge, New York. There, ever since 1976, the year before David's injury, they had weekended with the same people whose name Judy recalled for the priests. Were these people into the occult? Further, Melia asked. Do they hold a seance or something? No, Judy replied. All we did was snowmobile together. Father DiGiovanni asked if anyone in the family had been experimenting with the occult during those periods. Only in 1973, Judy said, but that was just the Ouija board. What was the purpose of using the Ouija board, Father Melia asked? Entertainment, Judy replied. Everybody's interested in the future. Now, they didn't tell them all. Let me tell it, because we're running out of time. As they kept probing, this family they weekended with were totally immersed in the occult. Skulls in their house. All the trappings of seances. Two distinct excursions into the occult and a curse placed on them by this family they snowmobiled with. What's the point I'm making? I don't want a great fear to descend on everybody out there. Usually, traced to the roots, you'll find an open door somewhere opened by the family, by the people, messing around with these occult items. Now, let's go back to the exorcism. You didn't think I would. Depart this seat of God's creation. Do you understand? I could have kept reading for another hour and taking you through the details. You can get the book of the occult magic experimenting family that they went snowmobiling with. The whole family was exposed. Now poor David is in the final throes of exorcism. In response came a sudden gasping heave. David's body restrained, both at hands and feet, arched violently into a bow, then froze in that posture. His breathing stopped. Anxious moments passed, but again it was only a tactic of interruption. Holy water was administered. David's body crashed to the floor. However, an animal wailing came out of the boy from the burns imposed by the holy water. It was a ruse for sympathy, but it didn't work. The Lord command you, His Son command you, His Holy Spirit command you, cease your audacity, cease your wickedness, flee from this boy. Depart and be gone from this child forevermore. I command you this in the name of Jesus Christ. His soul belongs to me. Depart from him. Never. Depart from him. No. Depart from him. His soul is mine. Depart from him. Stop it. Shut up. Shut up. Depart from him. Cease and depart from him. I'll kill you for this. There'll be no killing. Depart from him. I will kill him. You'll kill no one. Depart from him. I will possess another. You will possess no one. Depart from him. You have no authority. Depart from him. I don't obey you. God the Father commands you. God the Son commands you. God the Holy Ghost commands you. Be gone from this boy. Instead of rebuttal, there was silence. The entity that possessed David had fought ruthlessly to the end and was now weakened, depleted, and beaten. But until now, it made no concessions. By slow, barely perceptible steps, that boy, which the family knew as David, began to come back to them in the early morning light. The grimace that distorted the child's face slackened and relaxed. The unnatural strength in his arms and legs flooded away. Immediately, Father Vergulic addressed the entity, its menacing trace still evident in David's eyes. "Who are you? By the authority of the Blessed Trinity, I command you to give out your name or show a sign of departure." Only tortured sighs issued from David in response. Father Vergulic crouched down beside David where he lay on the floor and said, "Through the power of Christ, I command you, tell us your name or give the sign of your departure." This time an answer was given. The reply came not in a bellow or a shout, but in a voice that was distant and barely audible. It was only four words. "I am the devil." The time was 6:15 a.m., September 9th, 1980. That was the last exorcism, they thought. The possession of David Glatzel was over, they thought. Then comes the police report, CBS Morning News, March 20, 1981. Arnie Johnson arrested for murder in the scene I talked about earlier. As he tried to present his defense, the only time you'll find these Catholics criticizing the Catholic Church, they sought help from the parish in and around their town. The Catholic Church, according to this book, in that parish took a firm position. Their job began and ended with the exorcism of David. They would not be involved or lend any support to the events of Arnie asking the demon to come into him. The priests that were involved were moved away, some of them sent to Rome, and no witnesses from the church allowed to testify on Arnie's behalf. The family testify in the book to their felt utter abandonment by the church, and as Arnie's possession began to be felt, David came into trouble again. To get him finally exorcised, they had to leave the New England area, go to Quebec, find a parish with more sympathy for the reality of the situation, who sent a much experienced Catholic exorcist to exorcise David finally. In this exorcism, the demon identified himself as Beelzebub. Now, you who know the study of demonology know that in the Middle Ages, they went almost to the point of the ludicrous in setting up hierarchies of devils and demons. But salvaged out of the extremism are various names of demons in the authorized text, lost in the King James translation in some cases, and the book of Enoch is very specific in naming fallen angels with their assigned task. Now, as I go into Unger and others in the study of demonology per se, the major dividing line in the church, both Catholic and evangelical, is the distinction between devils and demons. In the Greek and in the Greek New Testament, the position firmed up one devil, many demons in a multitudinous hierarchical pattern. To those who believe that the demons are other than fallen angels, they have two broad categories, demons and devils. That's the category of the Warrens in their posture. To others, there's one devil, only demons under him. A third group has one devil as the supreme ruler, Lord and Prince of the Power of Darkness, who has under him, under devils, but they are subject to his directions. And Beelzebub traditionally fits into a lesser category under Lucifer, carrying out his commands. Either the demon in David was trying to play these games with full knowledge of the various hierarchical designations, or this demon lends support to the theological position of under devils. I think it's a semantical argument. There's only one prince of darkness. There are with him fallen angels who follow his command, probably part of his territory of assignment before his fall. And we haven't yet addressed the issue that is given most substance in the Apocryphal Book of Enoch, that the offspring of the sons of God mating with the women on earth, which is rather fully developed in the Apocryphal Book of Enoch, but certainly clear in the book of Genesis, produced an aberration called giants, but that's a bad translation. Nephilim, we'll talk about the word that is translated giants. It's really a bad translation because it doesn't necessarily refer to oversized people. These evil offspring represented Satan's first attempt in the minds of many, and I tend to share this view, to substitute his plan for God's earliest prophecy that by the seed of woman, incarnation in short, the substance of the divine, the eternal, moving into the flesh and blood and becoming kin with it. It was repeated as a substitute after the flood in the doctrines and devious ideas of Nimrod and Semiramis, who launched the Babylonian worship of Tammuz as conceived by a sunbeam and a reincarnation of the sun god Baal or Nimrod. But prior to the flood, there was this attempt of the evil fallen angels to produce a mixture, the aberration. And God had to destroy these evil creatures, leaving them, if the book of Enoch is correct, as bodiless spirits wandering, seeking a form to inhabit. Now, there are those in the theology, or demonology is a better word, not theology, the ology of demons, that argue these represent demons in the hierarchy, formless, seeking a form, and above them are fallen angels. So there's two classes there of fallen angels plus these formless, lost a body in the flood spirits floating around with their eternal nature, hunting rest and never finding it. But still in the fallen angel category, you have the hierarchy of Lucifer, prince of the power of the air, and under lieutenants who carry out his bidding, possibly with these demons, their sons, as the book of Enoch would talk about, for whom the watchers prayed and their prayer was denied. Now, all I'm really saying is that there is a deep and profound and broad study of demonology that has been a part of the Hebrew Christian tradition from the beginning. And you don't have to be a nut to come to grips with it. The experience of these people have the common traits. An exorcist from Quebec came down from Canada and performed the final exorcism on David and finished the job. But Arne Johnson was tried, convicted, and sentenced to the year 2001 for a murder. You be the judge when you read the eyewitness descriptions of the fight and the death. If that demon could do to Lou in the house where Annabelle was, he could do to the victim in the wrestling match with Arnie after he was hurled 20 feet away from Arnie and is stabbed by an invisible force. That Arnie's knife then is found later, open and with blood on it, 20 feet away to the side proves nothing. If these stories are correct, the demons have that power. The common denominator is, in every case, as you research the history, they're not random choices. There is a beginning and an opening of the door for the infestation. Now, I did finish the exorcism to the point of what the priests did who were shipped off to Rome. You can read the final exorcism, done well and complete, by the one from Ottawa. There was no binding of this demon. He stayed around to finish his work in Arnie. Father Cook. Oh, the front doorbell rang. That's where we left off with Annabelle. Right? Father Cook had arrived. The interview session ended in the kitchen as Donna got up and answered the door. You want me to quit?
No.
I mean, I never finished so much in one night in my life. I thought I'd do it. I'll get even with those people who went to bed on me. All kinds of people says, he's going to do it again, he won't finish. Tomorrow, I'm going to tell him I finished. Don't ever take me for granted. Don't take my exasperating talent for granted, because the night you go to sleep saying he'll do it again is the night I will sweetly tell it all. Aren't you glad you're here? Father Cook, whom Ed and Lorraine had never met in person, came into the kitchen. A tall, middle-aged man, the Episcopal priest, was clearly uncomfortable in his role as an exorcist. And let me tell you, if he comes that way, don't use him. That's my advice to you. If they don't know what they're doing, don't use them. Once the preliminary greetings were out of the way, Ed then told the priest that in his judgment, the spirit that was responsible for the malicious activity was inhuman. That it was still in the apartment, and the only way it could be made to leave was through the power of words written in the exorcism blessing. I'm not totally familiar with demonology, admitted Father Cook. How do you know such a spirit is behind the disturbance? They'd been better off with the first priest. Well, in this case, it wasn't all that difficult to determine, Ed said frankly. These spirits work in characteristic ways. What's going on here is essentially the infestation stage of the phenomenon. A spirit, in this case an inhuman demonic spirit, began moving the doll around the apartment through teleportation and other means. Now, again, I'm back to the Philadelphia experiment.
This is the end of Side 3. For the rest of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 4. Thank you.